You know that old joke, if it was fun, they wouldn't call it work? Somehow that's not the kind of thing people say anymore. Today, we're all supposed to love our work. It's not a job, it's a calling. Or if you listen to much political commentary, you kind of get the message that maybe we should all just shut up and be grateful to have any jobs at all.
What we have seen in the past 30 years is the rise of so-called, and here comes a very scientific term, bullshit jobs. These are the jobs that people who have them themselves say, no one really cares if I don't show up at work. I don't make the world any prettier, any wealthier, or whatever.
Journalist Rutger Bregman.
When I first heard about this phenomenon, I thought, well, it can't be that big. But then I started writing about it, and there was this huge outpouring of confessions of people writing and tweeting and Facebooking me about it. That yes, I have a bullshit job as well, people said.
And what are all these BS jobs? Burger flipping, pancake turning, bathroom cleaning? Nope.
They come from all parts of the economy. They're consultants, they're working in the financial sector, they're working in the marketing sector, they are working at administrative positions. They're very often also working in the private sector. Last year, there was the first poll about this phenomenon in the UK, and it turned out that 37% of all British workers said that they have a bullshit job. This is huge.
I'm Anne Strangehamps, and today on To the Best of Our Knowledge, Rethinking Work. Rutger Bregman will be back in a bit to tell us how to free everyone with a BS job. But first, wasn't the digital economy supposed to fix all this? And computers would do the boring jobs while people did the stuff that's fun and that matters. Instead, you know, we've got workers replaced by robots, taxi drivers losing out to Uber, and all those disruptive new media companies. Yeah, they're all laying off creative staff. So what went wrong? Media theorist Doug Rushkoff has a word for it: growth. Steve Paulson sat down to talk with him about his new book, Throwing Rocks at the Google Bus.
Doug, the subtitle of your new book is How Growth Became the Enemy of Prosperity, which I have to say sounds counterintuitive. Most people would say that growth goes hand in hand with prosperity.
Yeah.
So why is growth the enemy of prosperity?
You know, you would think it goes hand in hand, wouldn't you? I would have. The reason why is that for the most part now, companies grow by extracting money from people and places and some viable marketplace and then store that growth in share price. And when it's stuck in share price, it ends up really stuck there, almost like a frozen asset that they can't get back into circulation.
So you're saying the companies don't plow that money back into the business itself?
Right. And that's because they're punished, really, if they do that. You know, particularly in the digital economy, there's a real stigma associated with earnings. So you can have a company like Twitter, which makes $500 million a quarter, right? That's $2 billion of revenue a year. And that's considered an abject failure by Wall Street.
Wait, really? They're not making enough money?
They're not supposed to make money. That's the problem. If they make money, then you've got to be taxed on it. That's revenue. They don't want revenue. They want growth.
Explain the difference between growth and revenue.
There's the number of users on Twitter has stopped. It's now a great, sustainable, viable, revenue-based business. That means it's sort of standing still as far as investors are concerned. Investors buy stocks, and they don't want to get dividends from those stocks. They don't want earnings. They want the stock price to go up because that's an easy way to make money and not pay taxes. Your stocks go up. You want to see that line go up. You know, growth, we value growth. We think growth is the way to get richer, to do better, to make our country great. Grow, grow, grow. But it turns out growth of shares is very different from having a healthy, sustainable, revenue-generating business. And that confusion, really, is at the core of why our digital economy is not rewarding people.
I want to take you back for a moment to the Twitter example, because you actually know one of the co-founders, Evan Williams, right?
Yeah, I actually know a couple of them. I mean, I knew him when he was, you know, just looking for that next $100 to get, you know, to keep his servers up. You know, but when I saw him on the cover of the Wall Street Journal the morning that Twitter had its IPO, and they had the number $4.3 billion under his face, you know, which is the amount of money he earned that morning.
Wait, so one day he was suddenly $4.3 billion richer?
Yeah. I mean, it's got to feel good. I mean, it's because they went public. But, you know, I was also sad for him because I realized by taking $4.3 billion, he was going to surrender his company to this growth trap that now he was having investors who were expecting what they call 100x or 1000x returns. They put in money at that $4.3 billion, but they did it because they wanted the company to be worth $400 billion within a year or two. You know, that's what they wanted, was growth, not revenue. And I realized he had really given up his company, that he had, in some sense, killed the dream, because now Twitter, which is a successful company doing what it does, is going to be forced to do this very dot-com thing that they call pivoting. When a company pivots, it means get out of that business that you're in, that revenue-generating business, and go towards growth, even if you have to cannibalize yourself. Sell off your most productive assets. Sell your good businesses so that your share price will go up, and then we can sell our shares to the next round of investors. Hmm. And you keep doing that until the company's dead.
Well, let's talk about another example. I mean, you know, one of the hot tech companies is Uber, the ride-hailing service. I mean, you have argued that ultimately this is not a business about getting people to their destination. It's a business model. Do you want to explain
that?
Right.
It's a very particular business model too. I mean, the thing when you take venture capital at the of the amount that these young startups are taking, it's not in order for them to become successful businesses. It's in order for them to become what's known as a platform monopoly. That means you establish a complete and total monopoly in a particular area, like Amazon did with books, and then you leverage that monopoly to go into someone else's business, like streaming media or cloud services or big box retail.
So you're saying in Uber's case, I mean, basically the model is to drive all the taxi companies out of business, and then you get control over that whole industry?
Right. So because they don't really plan on making money in the taxi industry, what they do is they use their war chest of cash to undercut everybody else in the business, put every other taxi company out of business, even if you don't make a profit doing that. Doesn't matter if you make a profit. It doesn't matter if the drivers can stay alive doing it. It doesn't matter if you destroyed ride sharing and taxis, as long as you leverage your monopoly into another industry before you've completely killed the first one.
It's a fairly cynical way of looking at things. I mean, I don't know
it's
what
not cynical.
I don't know
it's
what
just,
Uber
I mean,
would say in response to that critique, that they don't actually, you know, they don't care about giving people rides.
That's not their business. That's not their job. Their job is to return 100x or 1000x returns to their investors. The only real problem with the system, other than that it's kind of destructive and stupid, the only real problem with it is that they don't take anyone into account other than the capital investor. You know, there used to be these three, what they called factors of production. That's the three things that you need for any business to happen. You need land, you need labor, and you need capital. So land is the place where it's happening, the town in which you're running your taxis, where you need roads in order for those taxis to run. There's the labor, who are the drivers, and there's the capital, which is the war chest that you use. Now, when you only value the war chest, you end up with disenfranchised labor, which is what we're seeing, people who can't earn enough driving Uber cars to keep themselves alive. And you end up with capitalists, with the people who are putting in the money, making all the decisions and getting all the returns.
Well, let's talk about workers for a moment. So you're saying that we need to take care of the workers. You know, they need to be part of this process, I mean, to benefit from all of this. What can be done to make work more rewarding, both in the monetary sense and in terms of what people want to do?
Well, the easiest thing is to make your workers owners of the company. There's a competitor to Walmart in Western United States now called Winco. And Winco is beating Walmart in every market where they're competing head to head. And the funny thing is Winco pays its workers more. And is a worker-owned cooperative. So instead of being owned by distant shareholders or the New York Stock Exchange, it's owned by the people who work there. So they not only pay themselves more as their bosses, but when the company makes money by, even if it's by exploiting them, they make money on the back end as the shareholders in the company. So you end up rewarded for all that overtime or anything that seemed uncompensated up front.
But why are they beating Walmart then? I mean, can they compete with Walmart in terms of prices?
They can compete with Walmart in terms of prices. And that's the thing that the Walmart people ask me. How could they compete with us in terms of prices if they're paying their workers more? This doesn't make sense. The reason why it makes sense is because they're not taking 90% of their revenue and handing it over to the shareholders. They don't have these millions of people passively making money off the company by simply owning shares.
Are you basically saying that that companies shouldn't go public?
If you have any choice, no, you should not go public. You should try to stay private where you can maintain some control over your company. Or we need to change the underlying code, the underlying bylaws of corporations so that you're allowed to do something legally other than increase the share price. When you're legally bound as a CEO to promote share price over everything else, you end up destroying your company. That's what the CEOs of the Fortune 100 tell me every time I meet one. I'm killing my company because I have to show growth for my shareholders. I'm selling off our most productive assets. I'm amputating our best limbs. I'm cannibalizing our company because I have to show growth. I wish there was a way I could convince them that we could be a successful company for the next 20 years if you don't force me to kill it right now.
So let's play this out a little bit. I mean, suppose a bunch of people realize what you've just been talking about, that especially in the digital economy, that, you know, there's something corrupt, there's something sort of withering about all of this, and, you know, the end game is not going to work out. What's the alternative? How could things be structured differently?
Well, the easy ones are things like platform cooperatives, where you have your workers own the platform. So if Uber, before they went public, if they said, look, we're going to take 10% of our shares and give them to the drivers, commensurate with how much they actually drove, that changes the whole equation. And that's a completely easy one. Of course, you could start a company from scratch that way, where your users are your owners. The difference between an industrial age economy and a digital age economy is that digital technology is distributed. It's networked. So the way you want to do business in a distributed age is to make your users rich. So that would be something like YouTube, say. YouTube right now gives a teeny little bit of the ad revenue that people get off their videos. It'll give it back to the person who put up the video.
Right.
It should be 50-50. If they did a 50-50 deal, could you imagine how many people are going to start making videos right. and trying to go in there and become part of that thing?
Yeah, right.
My mantra, really, for when I go and talk to these companies is make your users rich. Think eBay, which has millions of users who are dedicated to the platform because the platform has allowed them to generate income in a way that they really couldn't do that before. I mean, I don't mean to be sad. I'm actually happy because people are getting this. Developers are getting this. And they're realizing that the easy way to have a successful company is just take less money to begin with so that you're not beholden to these venture capitalists to pivot your business to some really awful thing which doesn't match what your initial intention was.
Douglas Rushkoff is the author of Throwing Rocks at the Google Bus, How Growth Became the Enemy of Prosperity. He talked with Steve Paulson. So if growth is a problem, maybe what American companies need is a slow movement, you know, like slow food or slow travel. Imagine what it would be like to work at a place where life wasn't all about the bottom line.
Hi, this is Maria Brott. I'm the CEO of the company Bratt. And we are situated in Örnsköldsvik in the northern part of Sweden.
Bratt is a tech startup. It's got 22 employees, a healthy balance sheet, and also something a bit more unusual. It's got a six-hour workday. Now, here in the U.S., if you get a job at a tech startup, you expect to be working 12-hour days and living on Soylent. But not if you're in Sweden and Maria's your boss.
Well, my brother and my mother started a company. And my brother, he's like an expert in our business. And before he started here, he'd been working a lot, many hours. And at his last job, I think he decided to just work a little bit less. And he saw a lot of benefits for himself. So they discussed it before they were going to start to hire people. They had like a list, bad things, good things, what could be good and what could be bad. And there's a lot of benefits for the staff. That's easy to see. Like, of course, you want to work less and get the same salary.
Really? So you pay your employees the same amount for a six-hour day as your competitors yes. pay for an eight-hour day?
Yes, we do. Because if we'd pay less, then they would probably have to find another job to cover up whatever they're missing. Uh-huh. And that would mean that they won't rest when they're supposed to rest. And our job is very creative. You have to work with your brain a lot. And you can only do that efficiently for a certain amount of time. And if you have to work longer, then you don't produce as much. So we find that we do what in 6 hours what other companies do in 8 hours. We've checked.
What do you mean you've checked? And how do you know that you're getting done in 6 hours what your competitors are doing in eight?
Well, some of the things we do, we can measure quite easily how much we produce. And we do know some of our competitors and we can ask them, how much do you do? And then we see that, well, we do the same.
Is this like how much code you write?
It could be something like how many articles can we write during one day? But that's not like the main thing. It's also think about how many people have read about us, heard about us and stuff. A lot of people want to work for us. So then we can attract them, we can hire them, but then also we'll keep them because we give them 6 hour workday.
What's your secret? I mean, how does your staff manage to do the same amount of work in 25% less time?
Yeah. Maybe the world has started to work too much. I think in many places it's going to the other way. Like you have to be online all the time. If you get an email at 10 o'clock at night, you're supposed to answer. If the phone rings when you're home, you're supposed to answer. And if you work a lot of overtime and you work and work and work, you get more and more tired and you produce less and less every hour. So by taking time off work, meaning like in the afternoon, in the evening, you get the break your brain needs to actually produce better the next day. And then you also get the more fun life because you can do other things.
Yeah. When you say you're more able to be more focused or more efficient at work, that must mean there are some things your staff aren't doing. I mean, I'm thinking about my own workday, which is considerably longer than 6 hours a day. And listening to you, I'm feeling guilty because I realize, okay, yes, I spend a certain amount of the workday, I don't know, surfing the web or checking Facebook. I mean, stupid yes. things that are just basically they're my way of giving my brain a rest for a bit.
Yes, you need a rest. And that's what you have to do that to get rest. And like in Sweden, what we do is we have I'm going to say it in Swedish, fika. We have coffee breaks. Not everywhere, but it's very common that like at 9 o'clock or 9:30, everyone gathers and have a coffee break.
Yeah, yes, great. I know.
And then you have lunch. And then at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, you have another coffee break. And then you sit and chat with your colleagues. Of course, we don't have the coffee breaks because we think, well, if you're only working 6 hours, you don't have time for coffee breaks. But in Sweden, there's a lot of they are concerned because we don't have the coffee breaks. And they are worried that we don't socialize so much because we just sit and work, like constantly. But we do socialize a lot. We have a good working environment. But maybe if I go and talk to someone and we say something and we laugh, I won't just stand there and chit-chat for 30 minutes. Mm-hmm. I'll do it in three. Mm-hmm. Because both of us will feel, okay, that was fun, but now we want to work because we have things to do.
So people don't arrive to work and feel like it's a sprint for six solid hours? They're just working at high intensity?
No, I don't think so. I think people come to work feeling quite happy most of the time. What I want them to use this time with is to make them feel better. Exercise or cook proper meal instead of eating something quick. Just see friends and do things that makes you happy.
So what is this like for you in practice in your own workday? For instance, I think it's about 4 p.m. for you. Are you done with work for the day?
Yes, this is actually overtime for me.
Sorry about that.
It's okay.
But so what's your normal work day like? When do you get to work and when do you leave and what do you do after you leave work?
Well, since I'm a single mom, I have my children 2 weeks out of 3. So I'll rush to school, get the kids, go home, cook dinner, and then just be with the kids until it's time for them to go to bed. Basically, what I do is work and just family.
Maria Brott. She's the CEO of Brott, a Swedish tech startup with a 6-hour workday. Speaking of tech startups, here's the story of a journalist who went from covering them to joining one, with kind of mixed results. Dan Lyons was a magazine writer and the technology editor at Newsweek, and then, one Friday morning, he lost his job. Who's 50 years old, with a wife and 2 kids. I mean, what do you do? Well, Dan decided to join the tech explosion he'd been covering. He scored a gig with HubSpot, a Boston startup that was flush with $100 million in venture capital. It tells the story of what happened next in a book called Disrupted, My Misadventure in the Startup Bubble. Doug Gordon wanted to know more.
Dan, what was your title at HubSpot?
I had a very funny title. My title was Marketing Fellow. It's a good one, right?
Yeah, I like it.
I sort of liked it because it made me feel like I was sort of quasi kind of academic. And I thought, well, I'm like an advisor to the company. I'm a fellow. I was twice the age of everybody there. The average age was 26. Most people were right out of college. And so I thought, well, I'm like the eminence grise. You know, I'm like the old guy who will, you know, whisper in the ear of the CEO, like, no, no, don't answer that question.
Yeah, the wisdom whisper.
Yeah. I can do that, too. I'm really good at that sort of like lean over. But no, I didn't know what I was supposed to do. They sort of said, well, our blog and our media operation is really pretty bad, and we want a real journalist to come in and build a real media thing for us. I said, oh, I could do that, you know. But it was very loosey-goosey.
Yeah. What did you think your colleagues thought of you?
A guy called me grandpa. So I think they thought I was old. You know, there's all this stuff about like, you know, do you know how to use Facebook? And I was like, yeah, I have a pretty big presence on Facebook.
Workplaces, even startups, I imagine. I've never worked one, but I imagine, although startups consider themselves doing everything kind of differently and reinventing work, but still there's a culture of conformity at workplaces. And then when you have this, that you're so obviously much older than everyone else, that's got to make you stand out, and not necessarily in a good way, which is not fair at all.
I think I would have not fit in even back when I was 25. I was always somewhat kind of cynical and curmudgeonly. I had an old friend of mine from college write to me. She read my book, and she said, it's so weird, you know, it feels like yesterday we were in college, and now you've become this grumpy old man. And I said, well, you know, I don't know if I'm that old. She said, no, but you were always grumpy, even in college. Well, you were in the college newspaper. You were always grumpy and dyspeptic and kind of...
A grumpy young man.
A grumpy young man, yeah. This place was very culty. It was very rah-rah and very much like, we're going to change the world. We're really great. This is so awesome. We're awesome. You know, they take pictures of themselves like jumping up in the air and stuff at work. They're all very cheery to be at work.
And you mentioned it was kind of like a cult. And one of the most cult-like things about HubSpot, I think, was the language, their own particular lingo that they used, which you describe as HubSpeak. Every workplace has their own sort of slang, but I get the sense that HubSpeak takes this idea of corporate lingo to a whole new level.
Yeah, they have this word delightion, which is like... It's a noun version of the noun delight, right? I mean, delight is already a noun, right? But they would say we engage in delightion, which is the process of creating a feeling of delight in our customers or delighting our customers. We call that delightion. And they would use this without any irony, without anybody laughing or kind of snickering into their fist.
Except for you, right?
Well, yeah, and I'm kind of like looking around going, you know, this is kind of crazy. And they would say things like 1 + 1 = 3. Our software is so magical and alchemical that it makes 1 + 1 = 3. And then they would say, I like that idea, but it's not 1 + 1 = 3 enough. You know what I mean? I'm like, no, I don't know what you mean. I actually don't. And I thought it was a perfectly good idea. The best one was when they fired people, they called it graduation. And then we would get this very cheery memo. It was like being in Scientology. You'd get this cheery memo that says, hey, everybody, just want to let you know, Derek has graduated and we're totally stoked to see what he does with his superpowers on his next big rock star adventure. Go, Derek. And then you'd look over and the guy's desk would be empty. Like, he just was gone. Everything was gone. And he hadn't even noticed. Oh, yeah, dude, I didn't even notice it. And he would never be spoken of again. Like, ever again. Never.
Yeah. And spam isn't called spam. It's called...
lovable marketing content.
Yeah.
And that's one of my favorites.
Yeah, it's great.
I spoke at Google a couple of weeks ago at a Google office in Boston, a big crowd, and they asked me the same thing. And even the Google people burst out laughing. I thought, okay, so it's not just me that thinks this is crazy. Like, even other techie guys think that's nuts. Yeah, lovable marketing content that engages in delightion and makes 1 + 1 = 3.
And that has lots of heart.
Oh, yeah, heart. I forgot about, yeah. Heart is the acronym for humble, effective, adaptable, remarkable, and transparent. And that's what every HubSpotter had to have in order to be what they called HubSpotty. And there would be a HubSpotty way of doing things. They would say something like, well, how about if we did this? And they're like, yeah, I'd like doing it that way, but that's not really HubSpotty enough. What would be the HubSpotty way of doing it? It's like, I don't know. What would be the HubSpotty way of doing X, Y, like eating lunch? What's the HubSpotty way of eating lunch? I don't know. Yeah, it was very scary and very humorless in a lot of ways. Like, people didn't want to joke about any of that. The best one was the teddy bear. One of the co-founders wrote this long essay on LinkedIn about how he was bringing a teddy bear to meetings, and that was like the stand-in for the customer, and he thought this was such a big innovation and that every company should do this, and he would put the teddy bear at the management meetings, and that way everybody in the meeting would remember that we're here to solve for the customer, which they would call SFTC, solve for the customer. And is that really an SFTC idea? I don't know. But and then when the teddy bear thing happened, I remember reading it and going, like, that's crazy. Like, that's really nuts. And I asked my boss, that young guy, I was like, dude, like, come here. Like, no, I didn't want to say it out loud. I was like, that's crazy, right? And he was like, no, I think it's a really good idea. I was like, no, you know that's crazy. But nobody would agree with me. And then I realized scarier than the teddy bear was the fact that 500 people would all not laugh at the teddy bear, that they would all just be like, yeah, that's really good. He's such a great idea. He's a great leader. He's a thinkfluencer. He's a visionary and a thought leader, you know? And like, oh, whoa. Yeah. I'm getting PTSD talking
about
this.
I can hear that. Yeah. And I'm sorry, I'm going to make you go deeper into your PTSD because we're not quite done yet. So your whole HubSpot experience sounds like this Kafkaesque Orwellian nightmare. It kind of makes the movie Office Space look like a documentary. And this experience, it sounds like it would have driven me crazy. But to be honest, that's a short ride.
That's a short ride.
For me, it is. Believe me. How did you manage to keep your sanity?
I know. It's a short ride for me, too. Well, for a long time, they sort of isolated me and stuck me in this room full of telemarketers and just gave me a desk in the corner. And it was really loud and it was just really horrible. And it was like, okay, they'll make you so unhappy, you'll go. And I just would start working from home and kind of writing my stories there. And I just tried to focus on other things and hang out with my wife and kids. I knew I would not stay there forever. So I think if you didn't know you were going to leave, it would be really hard. And I've had letters from people like, oh, you can't believe this. I've had like hundreds and hundreds of people writing to me telling me that they went through something similar to this in another wacko place. So I don't think this is isolated. I think a lot of people's work life is kind of like this now, which is amazing to me.
You've actually worked as a writer for Mike Judge's HBO TV series, Silicon Valley. And I imagine that that was a very refreshing change from your experience at HubSpot. My guess is that the other writers weren't saying, Dan, could you make this a little more Silicon Valley-y? That wasn't happening, was it?
No, it was very fun. It was great to be able to be cynical and dark and caustic again. You're with a bunch of people who are just like that all day long. So that was really hilarious. And I did 2 seasons with them. I worked on season 2 and then season 3. Now, next year, they'll work on season 4, but I won't go back to that.
Oh, is that right? Oh, that's too bad. Yeah. We'll look for the show to jump the shark without Dan Lyons content.
I think it's over. Yeah, it's all over now, pretty much. This was the last good season. I wouldn't watch it after this.
No. Were you able to draw on a lot of your HubSpot experiences in your writing for Silicon Valley?
A little bit. I think in season 3, the one that's just airing now, but the first 2 that have shown so far, I think there's a couple things that are sort of ideas that I contributed based on my experience at HubSpot.
Can you give me an example of one of the 2 ideas?
Yeah, there's a line in episode 2 about where they bring in an experienced CEO to help run the company.
You know, everybody in this industry, they say they want to make this world a better place, but we could actually do it. We could do it and make billions of dollars.
Richard, listen.
No, you listen to me, Jack. You promised me that you would never compromise the product. So, do you feel like taking some action and backing me up on this? Because me and my product feel pretty compromised right now.
Richard, I don't think you understand what the product is. The product isn't the platform. And the product isn't your algorithm either. And it's not even the software. Do you know what Pied Piper's product is, Richard?
Is it me?
Oh, God, no! No, how could it possibly be you? You got fired. Pied Piper's product is its stock.
Its stock?
And whatever makes the value of that stock go up, that is what we are going to make. Now, maybe sometime in the future, we could change the world and perform miracles and all of that stuff. And I hope we do. But like I told you before, I'm not going to mortgage the present for that. I need to move the needle today.
That's a bit from Silicon Valley, written by Dan Lyons, who's the author of Disrupted, My Misadventure in the Startup Bubble. He was talking with Doug Gordon. Coming up, why some people think there is a simple, practical way to free us all from wage slavery, a guaranteed universal basic income. Utopian dream or the next big thing? I'm Ann Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International.
Support for To the Best of Our Knowledge comes from Organic Valley, a co-op of family farms committed to bringing organic half and half to America's morning coffee. Organic Valley half and half is made with two ingredients, pasture-raised milk and pasture-raised cream. OrganicValley.com.
A guaranteed universal basic income, a monthly government check for everyone, for life, seems insane. But, you know, there are people who are starting to take this seriously. And these are people with real, even impressive, business experience, like Robin Chase. She founded a little company you might have heard of called Zipcar. She changed how we drive. Now she'd like to change some other things.
My dangerous idea is universal basic income, where each one of us gets a allocation from the government every month, no matter what, and I'd like to throw in health care and maybe child care into that mix. So if we had a basic income, first off, everyone would take better care of their children and take better care of their old people because now we would have time. The second piece is that we have a lot of artists and writers, musicians, and I want to say a whole bunch of engineers who are working on open source things. I know a lot of people that are working hand to mouth and doing really amazing work, environmental researchers, and they would be able to continue to do that. They would be supported, and so I think we'd have more people doing those types of things. All the types of volunteer work and if we think of what used to be women's work, all of that has real value. And as we've monetized everything, these things that aren't yet monetized, that have real social value, well, now, once again, people can pursue those and add value. I was also looking into kind of some negative things that would be righted. I was hearing about women who are cleaners, nighttime cleaners in offices, that they often are prey to a lot of sexual harassment, and those people can't quit their jobs. So all the people who are doing really hard jobs, dangerous jobs, bad jobs, if they could quit and fall back on basic income, I think we would suddenly see people being much better treated in the marketplace, and we would do away with those difficult, dangerous, or sexual harassment situations because people would just walk away. So the companies would have to step to the plate and treat their employees much better. I see it as a place where people will continue to work, will follow a lot more passions, will have much more creativity, and will have much better workplace conditions.
Robin Chase is the founder of Zipcar and author of Peers, Inc. And it's not just people like Robin who are talking about universal basic income. Governments in Switzerland, Finland, even Kenya are considering the idea. So could it get traction in the U.S.? Absolutely, says journalist Rutger Bregman. He's the author of Utopia for Realists, and he says the idea of a universal basic income has actually been explored in the U.S. before.
Yeah, it's a very old idea, actually. I think it goes back to, you could say, Thomas Paine, you know, the founding father of the United States,
or one of the founding fathers.
He actually argued in favor of a basic income in 1797. So, and he said that the basic income should be seen as a dividend of progress. So because our forefathers worked so hard to, you know, to create all these technologies and all these institutions and all these prosperities, that we can now give everyone a share of their accomplishments so that we can share this gift from the past. This is the very old idea, actually, and it's coming back every now and then. So there was a huge debate in England about it in the 1920s. There was a very big debate about it in the 1960s and the 70s in the US. And President Nixon almost implemented a modest basic income. And now it's coming back. So we're in the third round, actually.
The fact that Richard Nixon pushed for a universal basic income was really surprising to me. What was going on?
Yeah, well, many people see the basic income as a sort of a left-wing fantasy. But it might come as a surprise that there were many actually right-wing thinkers, for example, Friedrich von Hayek and Milton Friedman, you know, the famous neoliberal economists, who also argued in favor of a basic income. And they said it's a good idea because it's all about individual responsibility. And yeah, Nixon was a president who wanted to, you know, create this ultimate marriage between left-wing and right-wing policies. It almost happened.
How much was Nixon proposing as the basic income, and what would that translate into today?
It was about $10,000 for a family. The interesting thing is that the Democrats at that point said, well, this is a great idea. Let's introduce a basic income. But some Democrats in the Senate said it's not high enough. Huh. So they voted against it.
Yeah. Well, but speaking of the financing, I just don't see how a country, especially a country as big as the U.S., how would a country be able to afford to give everybody a basic income of, you know, say, $10,000?
Well, I think you have to look at the net result. So not everyone, of course, would profit. There are many people who would receive a basic income, but who would see their taxes rise by the same amount. So there won't change much for them. And there are also many people who would receive a basic income, many, for example, the billionaires, but see their taxes rise by much more. So I think you really have to look at what's the net redistribution of a basic income plan, and then you'll see that it's actually not about that much money. You know, it's actually pretty cheap to eradicate poverty. There's one economist who calculated that it would cost about $175 billion to completely eradicate poverty in the United States. Well, that's of course a lot of money, but it's only a quarter of the country's military budget. And one study that was conducted in 2013 shows that only child poverty, the costs of only child poverty, are actually $500 billion. So I always say, you know, we can't afford poverty. It's too expensive.
Well, why not just give money to the poor then, or to anybody who's below the poverty line? Wouldn't that cost less?
Well, I think there's a good reason not to do so, because if you would make it a universal basic income, then there would be no stigma attached to it, to receiving the benefit. And we also see this nowadays. So the welfare states that have the most universal programs nowadays are actually the most successful in reducing poverty, because the middle class also profits. There's one, actually, the architect of the British welfare state once said that a policy for the poor is a poor policy. And I think that's true.
But I guess what I don't understand is, if you raise the income for everybody, isn't that just going to basically change the cost of living so it all just gets canceled out?
Well, that would definitely happen if you just print the money. You know, if you finance it by starting the presses. This is what Milton Friedman, the economist, called helicopter money. And there's actually a lot of economists, very famous economists even, who are saying that we should do this right now, especially in Europe, where we have deflation and we actually need inflation. So some people are proposing that we should do this. But obviously, this is not a long-term solution. So you'd have to finance the basic income with taxes. And in that way, the total money supply wouldn't rise. So that's interesting. I always get this question. People never don't ask about, will everyone be lazy or can we even afford it? No, the first question is always, won't it just cause massive inflation?
So what's the closest that any country has come, do you think, to trying some of the things we're talking about? Are there places that you think are really kind of taking this seriously?
Well, there's this huge surge of interest in the idea of a basic income. So Switzerland is having a referendum in June. Finland has announced a very big experiment. There's going to be an even bigger experiment in Kenya that will last about 10 years. The really interesting thing is that the debate is really international nowadays. And what I also think is that there's a new generation. You know, I'm 28, and I really meet many young people who say, you know, I'm not really into left-wing politics or right-wing politics. I just want to have a big state in terms of redistribution, to give everyone a chance to make something of their lives. But I want to have a small state in terms of paternalism. And our political landscape nowadays doesn't really give that option, you know? It's you're either left-wing and paternalistic, or you're right-wing and you're against redistribution, and you mostly want to force people into work. What I think that's happening is that there's sort of a new ideology emerging. You could say it's sort of a new version of anarchism. It's really interesting to see what will happen with that.
And say more. What do you mean it's a new version of anarchism?
Well, the anarchists, you know, they were always regarded as the crazy ideology that didn't turn out to work. They want to abolish the state. So I'm not in favor, of course, of abolishing the state. But what I do think is interesting in the works of many famous anarchists, like, for example, Peter Kropotkin, the Russian anarchist, he had a very positive image of human nature. So he and many other anarchists as well thought that, you know, most people are pretty nice. You know, they want to do something with their lives, and you know, mm-hmm. you can trust them if you just give them the means to do so. And this is a quite radical idea that may start to spread. It's just not represented yet in our politics.
Radical goodness. I like it.
Yeah. It's sort of you could call it the banality of the good, you know? We always, you know, especially if you watch a lot of the news, you know, you always hear about the exceptions. So mm-hmm. I always say you should never watch the news, because at the end of the day, you know exactly how the world doesn't work. Because you've only seen exceptions like terrorism and corruption, et cetera, et cetera. But the norm in our societies is just goodness, banality of goodness, simple forms of cooperations and, you know, people opening the door for you and helping you carrying a bag or whatever. You know, it's all around us. Most people are pretty nice. It's just that it's never on the news.
Except here. Rutger Bregman is the author of Utopia for Realists, The Case for a Universal Basic Income, Open Borders, and a 15-Hour Work Week. Next, meet the CEO who built an empire of boutique hotels based on Abraham Maslow's hierarchy of needs. Does that mean you could get a non-smoking double with ensuite bath and self-actualization? I'm Anne Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. We all want more from our work than just a paycheck and decent hours. We want to do something we care about, something that matters. The quest to build a corporate culture around meaningful work led Chip Conley to found a boutique hotel chain based on the ideas of Abraham Maslow. And Maslow was the psychologist who invented this famous concept, the hierarchy of needs. It looks like a pyramid with food and shelter at the bottom and self-actualization all the way at the top. That's the place where people reach their full potential. So what would a self-actualizing company look like? Here's Chip Conley with Steve Paulson.
I was the founder and CEO of a boutique hotel company, and we had become the largest hotel company in the Bay Area. And in 2001, when the dot-com bust started, we were running out of cash. We had about 6 weeks of cash left to make payroll. We had 21 or 22 hotels in the San Francisco Bay Area at the time, and the market was in free fall down. And so I went to the local bookstore looking for a business book, and I ended up in the self-help section, which is where I got reacquainted with Abraham Maslow's psychology theory. He's famous for the hierarchy of needs theory. It spoke to me on a personal level, but it also really said to me, gosh, if individuals can be self-actualized at the top of the pyramid, at the peak of the pyramid, why couldn't a company, since companies are full of individuals? And so I came back to the senior executives in my company, and I had the persuasion power of being the founder, and I just said, I want to reapply Maslow for our company and see if it works. And we applied it and created a hierarchy of needs for employees, for customers, and for investors.
What does that mean, a hierarchy of needs? I mean, how does that apply to a workplace?
Well, for employees, it means actually when I did a little research, I found that the pyramid, a three-level pyramid for employees would be money at the base of the pyramid or compensation package, recognition in the middle, and then at the top of the pyramid's meaning. How do you create meaning? And literally, we had housekeepers, we're a hotel, so we had people cleaning toilets. So, you know, what their business card should say toilet cleaner on some level if it's functional. But, you know, we really actually sort of asked our housekeeping staff, what is it that you do if we really took a step back? If a Martian came down and saw what you did for the guests every day, what would they call you? And we did that exercise literally with hundreds of maids in a room. And we've got things like, I'm the mom away from home. Or we're here, we're the peace of mind police. We help you as the housekeeping staff feel like when you come back to your room at the end of the day, it's not just orderly, but maybe even there's a little written note saying, I hope you had a great day.
And you're serious about this. I mean, because the cynic might think, oh, this is a line that the CEO is feeding us about why the maid cleaning the toilet is going to feel good about her job. I mean, you're saying these house cleaners, they meant this. I mean, this is why the job was meaningful
to
them.
It gave meaning. So we started actually doing research, interviewing our staff throughout the whole company, asking them, not the question is what gives you meaning, but asking a question like, what made you feel good in the last month?
Okay, so this is how Abraham Maslow's hierarchy of needs applied to the people working in your company. What about to your customers, to the people staying at your hotels?
So the pyramid for customers, if there's a three-level pyramid, would be the expectations, meeting expectations at the base. And most companies get very fixated on that. Like, okay, in the hotel business, that means, you know, was it a clean room? Was the check-in efficient? At the end of the day, though, that's not why you create loyalty. Loyalty is created a little bit higher. So the second level of this pyramid is meeting the desires of a customer. Was the staff friendly to you? Did you get a note from the general manager? Did you get upgraded to a room with a view? So those are the kinds of things that are meeting desires. But at the top of this pyramid is this very intangible thing of meeting the unrecognized needs of the customer. And that means you have to be a mind reader. You actually have to know your customer better than they know themselves and maybe understand what they would love to see as a customer that nobody else has been doing. And that's where innovation happens. Generally, companies that are good at the top of this pyramid, the customer pyramid, have evangelical customers, customers who fall in love with them, and they're your biggest marketing team.
So what are some examples of these unrecognized needs, whether at your company or at other companies?
For me, with my hotel company, it was trying to understand the person. I understood for one of my hotels that we needed to put a yoga studio up on the top floor, the penthouse floor of a financial district hotel, which 15 years ago when we were doing this didn't make any sense to my investors. But it made sense to me that the people who are actually going out and growing the yoga craze in this country were generally people who were business people, affluent, and when they travel, they're out of their rhythm.
What do you see in the best CEOs? Do they have personal qualities of leadership?
Yeah, I think the best CEOs are a combination of being vulnerable and confident at the same time, which sounds oxymoronic. It's hard to be both, but it starts by being authentic and real so people trust you.
So this is something that you've had to deal with in your own life, show vulnerability to people who work for you?
Yeah. I unfortunately, at the start of the Great Recession in August 2008, I had a flatline experience and literally died on stage after a speech. But 3 months later, I'd created this equation that came from Viktor Frankl's Man's Search for Meaning, which is despair equals suffering minus meaning. I came up with that the night that this flatline experience happened. And so I actually shared that equation, despair equals suffering minus meaning, with our senior executive team, our 80 top leaders, at our annual conference 3 months later. And I did that partly because what I saw in the company was more and more suffering and a lot of fear because we were going into a historically deep recession and the travel industry gets creamed in a recession. So I was supposed to give this speech to our top 80 leaders and my top two people in the company gave me a speech and it was a cheerleading speech. And I said, the last thing I should be doing is getting up there and talking about something false and just trying to rah-rah through this. So not only did all these executives in the company have to hear, whoa, Chip actually had a flatline experience. We didn't know it. Oh, and Chip's actually telling us next year is going to be a really bad year. We were hoping he was going to tell us it was good. But the fact that he's being vulnerable and he's being real with us meant we could have a very thoughtful 90-minute conversation that led to 2.5 days together of really huge progress.
How did people respond when they heard that you had nearly died?
Cry. There were people were crying. I was crying on stage. They were crying in the audience. And I think more than anything, people realized how fragile life is and yet how bonding the experiences in work can be. There's a great, in rowing, there's an actual state of being in rowing when you get all of the crew members rowing at the same time. They call it swing. And what happens is the boat actually starts to lift slightly out of the water because everybody's in unison and it moves faster. That describes any organization, for-profit or nonprofit, that is really, they're swinging. And so I guess this is what we call a swinging company.
That was Chip Conley talking with Steve Paulson. Conley's the head of global hospitality and strategy for Airbnb. He's also the author of Peak, How Great Companies Get Their Mojo from Maslow. Hey, thanks for listening today. To the Best of Our Knowledge comes to you from Wisconsin Public Radio. Doug Gordon produced today's show with help from Charles Monroe Kane, Raymond Tungekar, and Craig Ely. Our theme music is by Steve Mullen from Walk West Music. Kirill Owen is our technical director. Steve Paulson is our executive producer. And I'm Ann Strainchamps. We'll be back next week.
PRI, Public Radio International.